welcome to the Road to Genome podcast, with this episode being brought to you jointly by the Genomic Medicine Service in both the northeastern Yorkshire and the southeast. I'm your host, Helen Bethel, genetic counsellor and workforce development and education lead. Today we're recording inside the busy Guy's Hospital, which sits in the heart of London. I'm delighted to be joined by Nikki Smith, who is here to share her journey into her current role, where she's training to be a clinical scientist. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, Helen.
Hi. Can we start by me asking you what your current job title is?
Yeah, sure. I'm a trainee clinical scientist in cancer genomics. I'm on the scientist training programme, which is run by the National School of Healthcare Science. So that's a three-year programme, sort of work-based, but also there's a master's element to it. So mm-hmm. you do a master's in clinical science at Manchester Uni. So I've just finished my first year, literally just
well done.
Yeah, thank you. Just starting the second year, so I'm off on to placement next week for 10 weeks in haematology, which I'm looking forward to.
Fantastic. So it's a training program. What is it you're training to be?
So I'm trained to be a clinical scientist in cancer genomics. So you have to do that, you have to do different rotations, see different aspects involved in cancer genomics. So it depends on which specialism you apply for.
And yours is cancer, is that right?
Yeah, cancer genomics. So within our teams, I'm based here at Guy's, within our intake last year, there was two trainees who are on pure genomics. So they're dealing with rare and inherited diseases.
Okay.
Whereas the cancer genomics intake is looking at the genetic changes in cancers specifically. And there was also a couple of clinical bioinformatics. So we all work in the same office, which is really nice. So they all complement each other quite well.
Yeah. And is there a genetic counselling arm to it as well?
There is, yes. Mm. They're on the same floor. They're in a slightly different part of it. But the cancer genomics doesn't actually cover the genetic counselling. Mm-hmm. We don't have a rotation in that, whereas the genomics trainees do. And interestingly enough, the bioinformatics do as well. And they've all fed back that it's been really interesting. I think it would have been actually quite nice for the cancer genomics to see that element of it. I think that would be good. But the way the cancer genomics is set up is, so in the first year, it's very much shadowing. Mm-hmm. We spent sort of 4 weeks at St. Thomas's Hospital mm-hmm. in the histopathology department, mm-hmm. which was really interesting because then you get to see where the samples are coming from. And 4 weeks in our department, in the mm-hmm. cancer genetics, cancer genomics, sorry, I should say, mm-hmm. department, which is split into the solid tumours mm-hmm. and the haematological malignancies.
Mm-hmm. So blood-related.
Blood-related cancers. Yeah. Predominantly so far, I've had more involvement in the solid cancers. We haven't mm-hmm. done the rotation that's going to start next week. So as I said, we did 4 weeks in St. Thomas's mm-hmm. and then 4 weeks at King. So you get
that's
to go
really
through
exciting.
It to different hospitals, which is great. And that was haematology, but wasn't haematological malignancies, that was other blood disorders. Mm-hmm. So things like thalassemias mm-hmm. and sickle cell disease. We're getting mm-hmm. We didn't have much involvement in that. It was just kind of shadowing to see, getting an idea of the different aspects mm-hmm. of that. And there's also the university part. So that complements it really well. So we spent 3 weeks at the beginning of the training up in Manchester, where we did bioinformatics, which was very new to me.
Yeah.
Thankfully, didn't have to do any coding or anything like that. It was just kind of getting an overview of the pipeline that's involved mm-hmm. again in how, when a patient sample is taken mm-hmm. and sequenced, there's a bioinformatics pipeline that goes behind making sure that the sequences align to the reference genome mm-hmm. and variants are called. So getting an idea of that process, although we don't get involved in that process, it's
good to know. Yeah, it gives
gaining
it
an
context,
understanding,
doesn't it? Yeah.
So at uni, we also did another week with haematology, mm-hmm. another week with histopathology. So each of the uni rotations complements mm-hmm. the rotations that we do on site.
Yeah.
And then actually the last couple of months, because we'd finished with rotations and finished with our uni work mm-hmm. and our exams, I've actually been involved in service work, which has been really interesting. I've actually had a chance to contribute to service work, which I've really enjoyed.
Yeah. So as a clinical scientist, what is that role? am I right in thinking the STP is 3 years?
It is, yeah.
So after that 3 years, what will you then be qualified to do, and what does the job look like that you'd be trained to be able to do?
So having not seen every aspect of it, there are lots of different elements, different assays, different tests, different methods of sequencing the patient's tumour samples. But the part that I've been involved in so far, which is something that would become the role in the future, is when the tumour samples, so taking the patient pathway starting from the beginning, after a clinician has obviously diagnosed a patient with cancer, then the patient has their tumour, either a biopsy or a resection taken, and that gets sent to the histopathology lab. The histopathologist will then do their special stains and their diagnosis and decide that they want genetic testing on a certain part of the tumour to see if there's any molecular elements that could be targeted by specific drugs. So the histopathology department will prepare slides or curls, which they send off to us in the solid tumour department and down in the lab, which we don't get involved with the lab work as such. But we did get to see shadowing of that. We get to see each of the elements. So it's important to obviously understand the process that's producing the end results. So in the labs, then the DNA is extracted from sample and RNA, which whatever is appropriate, whatever the clinician has requested to see what it is that they want the results on. And that DNA or RNA then gets put through a sequencer. And the part that I've been doing the last couple of months, we get the results from the sequencer. And so you look at the referral form, you see what the suspected diagnosis is, you get to see a little bit of the history, not too much, there's not too much involvement in that, but you see a little bit of the patient history. You then look at the results that have come off the sequencer, and depending which cancer type it is and what has been requested on the National Test Directory, so there's National Test Directory for cancers, and there's a separate arm for sort of rare and inherited diseases, but depending on what test has been requested, you then have to obviously go through a QC process to make sure that all the data is reliable, and then look to see if any variants have been called, and then it's kind of doing the analysis on that information and producing a report, which is then ultimately going to be sent to a clinician.
And did you say you've been involved in some element of that work recently? How's that been?
Yeah, it's been great. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. It was a steep learning curve. I mean, I'm only training at the moment. So the part I've been involved in is doing the analysis and writing a report, and then that gets checked by a registered clinical scientist and then checked again by an authorising clinical scientist before the results are sent out to the clinician. But no, it's been really interesting. It's a lot of variety, I'd say. So I've only been involved in sort of maybe 4 or 5 different cancer types, and within each of those there's possibly, depending on the cancer type, sort of 3 or 4 different genes they're actually looking at that they're interested in, and they're interested in those because those are the ones that are targetable. So they're looking at specific gene mutations that could impact the patient's care, whether there'd be a specific drug that can target that specific mutation. So it's been about learning the different genes and learning the different regions within those genes and learning specific mutations. But it's surprising actually how frequently the same ones come
up. I was going to ask you, so in the results that you've been working on, have you found anything that is actionable within those results you're working on?
Plenty. I think in the last couple of months, I've probably done probably near on 200 lung cancer cases, which I've been involved in on predominantly. That seems to be a lot of those, surprisingly, that come through.
There's a lot of work being done nationally on that,
Yeah, definitely. And right at the beginning, because I've come from a research background, when there weren't any variants being found, I was my research brain switched on, and I was like, why isn't there any variants? If it's not that, what is it? So that was kind of, I have had a little bit of difficulty at times trying to switch off the research brain and switch on the clinical service brain. What could it be if it's not that? But it doesn't mean that there's not variants. It's just because the panel that is being used, it's a fairly small panel. It's targeted to specific genes because they're the ones that are of interest. So there are obviously other genes that could be involved or other causations that aren't known about at the moment. So right at the beginning, I was like, oh, okay, well, if it's not this, what is it? And I was also very interested in the fact that because these ones are coming up so frequently in specific regions, it's like, why is it always this region, one? Why is that this always happening? So definitely you see the same mutations regularly.
Yeah.
And often they are targetable, and then sometimes they're not, because sometimes those mutations are actually suggesting that tumour is resistant to particular therapy, which is disappointing.
But, you know, even in that instance, knowing, as you say, that it's not going to respond to that particular treatment, knowing it from the outset to just shorten the journey for that patient so they don't at least try with the hope that it's going to work and then be disappointed at a much later stage, when actually those weeks are crucial for those early treatments, is such a huge impact for those patients.
Absolutely, yeah. And obviously it's not the end of the road for their treatment, because if there's not a variant found in that particular, it might actually open a different avenue. It might be that, okay, that targeted therapy is not available, but there are obviously standard of care treatments and other treatment options that might be available. I have to remember that if something's not favourable in the context of targeted therapies, there are still other options open.
So it sounds absolutely fascinating, the work and the trainee program. Is this what you'd always aspired to do?
No. I think the earliest memory probably of wanting to be a scientist was, so when I was at school doing my GCSEs, I loved maths and I loved science. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any idea really of what I wanted to do. They were the only subjects I did enjoy: chemistry, biology, maths. I didn't particularly enjoy school, to be honest. I didn't find that way of learning particularly suited to me. I find that I study better by myself, so I would actually prefer just reading books at home. I found that more beneficial. So I can't say I loved my school experience. But I do remember that we had a careers fair at the school. So a local, because I lived in Thanet at the time, and a big pharmaceutical company that was based in Thanet at the time came and visited the school. Yeah. And I was like, oh, yes, that sounds really exciting. That's what I want to do. I'm going to do that. Yep, great. And then an army careers people came and visited the school. I was like, oh, that sounds really exciting. I'm going to do that. So I was kind of a bit, not really sure what I'm going to do. But I think I fairly quickly dismissed the army. It did appeal in some respects, but I thought, no, okay, maybe that's not really for me. Right. It's going to be that route. I'm going to go into science. But around that time, they sent you off for work experience. Mm-hmm. So I spent, I think it was only about a week or something, in a local company. And it wasn't a particularly exciting job. It was sort of doing admin. But I remember really enjoying it. I felt like a grown up for a week. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is nice. Maybe I just want to work.
Yeah.
So right at the last minute, even though I think I was also actually a bit of a rebellious teenager, I think because my mum was quite insistent that I was going to do my A-levels, it kind of made me quite insistent that I wasn't.
Yeah.
So I derailed at the last minute to my detriment and decided I was going to work instead.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's what happened.
Okay. So what was the path like then from kind of going into a workplace to now being on an STP programme? What twists and turns did you take then?
Twists and turns. Okay, so I'm not sure what I could even count as my first job, because I had quite a lot of jobs. So it's not that I changed jobs, but I had a lot of part-time jobs. I worked in, I think my first main job was working in a bank.
Mm-hmm.
My mum worked in a bank. So surprisingly, even though I'd rebelled against her, I followed her path into a bank. So I worked in a bank for a couple of years. And then they were offering a voluntary redundancy. So I thought, okay, yeah, this isn't really my life career. I'm going to take the voluntary redundancy. I'm going to go and travel. So that was my plan. I think I was quite, spontaneous. I jumped into things quite quickly. It's like, okay, I'm leaving that and now I'm going to go and travel. But that didn't happen either because then I bought a horse. So, randomly. I think I was quite random at that age. Yeah, it was like anything that felt right at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought, okay, now I need a job or a few jobs to pay for this horse. And so then I had another job and I had part-time jobs in the evening, bar work and all sorts. I was probably working too much that I couldn't even ride my horse very often.
Yeah.
So at some point, I think it was when I was working in one of the bars, that somebody had suggested to me that, oh, you'd make a good police officer. I'm like, really? It hadn't been anything that I had considered. Yeah. So I started looking into it and I thought, maybe that's, I think I could do that. I, you know, be helping people. That'd be interesting. And I think... I hope my mum never listens to this. But when I went home to my mum and said, oh, I think I might be a police officer. And she said, oh, don't be so ridiculous because you're way too squeamish, which I really am. I'm so squeamish. It is ridiculous. So obviously that was the motivation I needed to join the police. I was like, great. You can't do that. Okay, I will. So I joined the police at 19.
Yeah.
It was about a month before my 20th birthday. I love certain aspects of that. I did that for 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah, that was, I would say there's many elements in the police that I look back on fondly and many elements that I don't.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really for me. I mean, the squeamish part actually never entered into the equation because I found that even though I am incredibly squeamish, that when you're involved in a situation, you just have to get on and deal with it and then think about it afterwards. So it was actually never a problem. I think probably not a problem so much, but I'm not a confrontational person. And so dealing with confrontation all the time I couldn't see myself doing that forever. And I think I felt that, I think I knew that as soon as I arrived on the first day, actually, because I do recall as I, 19-year-old turning up at the police station at the front desk, the police officer who'd 30 years service greeted me and said, welcome to the next 30 years of your life. And I kind of thought, oh, 30 years at 19, it's really hard to envisage 30 years of your life.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe. No, it kind of spooked me a little bit.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy it. I mean, mostly, I think possibly the best elements in the police force is you can often work with really great teams. So the teamwork is something
Did you ever work alongside any of the forensics with the science or anything like that with that?
I was interested in that, actually. I did think about forensics at one point, but it's quite... I would say a lonely position because you're often working on your own all the time, and I do like working in a team. So I thought that's not for me. I like being around other people. So then after I left the police, I worked in the employment tribunals.
Oh, wow.
I think that was possibly because it was what I felt most qualified for, being in the judiciary, was what I was most familiar with, and I had left my school with GCSEs. I didn't have A-levels or anything, and it was something that best suited to my skill set at that time.
Yeah.
And that was okay. It was a sort of admin role. Again, the team was great. So although it wasn't the job that I wanted to be doing, I was working with really nice people. And then towards the end of that, so during that period, I'd had my daughter during the time I was in the police, and then I had my son when I was in tribunals, and then again 10 years, it seems to be a pattern, 10 years in police, 10 years in the tribunal service, and I'm not sure what made me start reevaluating my life, but I can kind of pinpoint a couple of triggers. There was a lady who worked in the tribunals, and I had a conversation with her one time, and she was talking about her uni experience, and I kind of felt a little bit of envy. I thought, I really wish I had done that. I don't regret any of my decisions because each of those has brought me to a certain place in my life, so I don't regret those choices. But I did feel a little bit of pang of envy, like, oh, I wish I had done that. If only I'd done that, I wonder what I could be doing now.
Yeah.
And there was also a police officer I was working with one time, and she'd actually done a biochemistry degree, I think it was, and she decided the police wasn't for her and she was going to go back into science. And that stuck in my mind, even though we're talking sort of 25, 30 years ago, I can remember. So I think that might have been
another trigger
point for me. But I didn't actually think there was really a route into science. Now, I thought I'd kind of I'd missed that opportunity. So I knew tribunal service, again, wasn't going to be... I mean, to me, what's important is something you really love.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't get a job you really love, then working with really great people is a near substitute.
Second best.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But I knew I wasn't feeling fulfilled in mm-hmm. what I was doing, and I did want a bit of a challenge. I do mm-hmm. like a bit of a challenge. So, as I said, I didn't think I could get into science, but I started to look into mm-hmm. it. And so I started thinking about science again, and healthcare science particularly. So, strangely enough, I'm not sure where the idea came from, but I thought maybe radiographer might be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually visited a local hospital, and they were brilliant. Actually, they gave me a whole day in the radiology department.
Yeah.
But my mum was right; I am really squeamish. broken bones! It wasn't for me.
At least you figured that out before you started
really
training.
Quickly. I tried to desensitize myself by watching like hospital programs on the TV. My neighbours must have been going, "What's going on?" So I knew that was definitely not for me. I mean, the MRI scanner was amazing, and also like the nuclear medicine part of it. Mm-hmm. I thought, wow, that's really cool. But I knew I wasn't going to be able to get over the squeamishness of the broken bones. So. So I think about biomedical scientists
mm-hmm.
and what I would need to do that. And I was like, oh, you need a degree. I haven't got A levels. Then I found that one of the local universities did a foundation degree
mm-hmm.
and it was actually associated. It was a 4-year degree. It was in biosciences, which I didn't want to do. But mm-hmm. I knew that if I did the foundation degree, I could then switch to biomedical science mm-hmm. afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. 23 years after finishing school and having absolutely no idea what biology
wow.
was,
yeah,
I decided I was going to do a biomedical science degree.
That's incredible.
Yeah. I think it's only incredible in that I was lucky that I didn't know what it entailed.
Because if you did, you might have questioned
yeah.
it. So after you'd done your foundation degree, what was next?
So after the foundation degree, that gave me the qualifications to be able to apply to the biomedical science degree.
Mm-hmm.
The route I was planning at that point was to be a biomedical scientist.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to uni to do that, which was challenging, I would say, having been so long out of education. I would say the first year was pretty challenging, mm-hmm. but actually...
Being a mum at that point as well.
Yeah, actually, funnily enough, there was a funny story behind when I applied for the degree at University of Kent. It was... So my son was 8 and my daughter was 18. And when you go to these open days, don't you, at the university?
Yeah.
So I dragged my daughter along with me to the open day. And they had all the parents and young adults there with their parents. And it was all in this room. And they said, okay, right, now we're going to do the tours, but we're going to do them separately.
Mm-hmm.
So all the parents go to one side and all the applicants form this group. So I was like, oh, no. So obviously I went off and joined the applicant group and my daughter joined the parents group and people were looking like, oh, look at them. They've got the wrong group. They're looking, oh, no. She's gone in the wrong group.
Yeah.
But
good on you, though.
Yeah, it was quite funny. And there was a point when we did a lab tour, I was back with my daughter at this point, and I was saying, oh, have a look down the microscope. Have a look to the applicants. Come and have a look down the microscope. So I'm saying to my daughter, go on, go and have a look.
Yeah.
She's going, no, mum, it's you that wants to be here. Yeah, I did feel a little bit silly, but...
Did you feel a fish out of water when you actually got to uni then? Or did that ease?
I think the foundation degree was good for making me not feel like that so much because mm-hmm. there were other
That's
mature
great.
Students there.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually two different routes you can... Mm-hmm. I didn't know this at the time, but there was actually two different routes you can get into uni mm-hmm. if you haven't got A-levels, which I found out after I got to uni because my friend who I met at uni, who is also
had
a mature
a
student, had done a different path. So she had... She did an access course to get into
okay,
uni.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there was another lady there who did an access course as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not disappointed I didn't do the access course because I think the foundation degree seemed to be more science focused. Mm. The subjects were all science focused, so
a better fit for you.
Better fit, yeah. And actually, when I was doing the foundation degree, I loved the biochemistry. I think I'm quite an easily influenced person, so I seem to be influenced by, especially by lecturers and people who are excited in science. Yeah. So when I was doing my foundation degree, the lecturer in biochemistry, he was so excited about chemistry. You know, it made you really engaged with it. And I was like, oh, okay, biochemistry, that's for me. You see how easily I can be swayed. Okay, I'm biochemistry. And I think I had actually been put off biology. I felt like biology, human biology, is what I was interested in, but not knowing a great deal about it. I had been slightly put off in biology. Again, squeamishness coming into it was, well, you have to dissect a human eyeball. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm out of here. There's no way I'm doing that. So I was out of there. And the biology lectures I didn't find quite as engaging as I mean, the chemistry guy was just amazing. I was like, oh yay, chemistry, this is for me. And I think I also quite, with chemistry, what I like about it is it's more mathematical. Mm-hmm. You get sort of X plus Y equals Z. Mm-hmm. Whereas with biology, as you know, X plus Y could equal any letter of the alphabet.
Yeah.
And then keep swapping around.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But again, when I went to University of Kent, it was one of the lecturers in biology who just enlightened the room and made biology so interesting. I'd applied for both. I'd applied for biochemistry and biomedical science because I wasn't sure. Mm-hmm. And I thought if I was doing biochemistry, then possibly then you've got the nuclear medicine element to it. Mm-hmm. But I went for an interview and I spoke to a lecturer there and I sort of told him what I was interested in. I told him it was sort of healthcare medicine. So he said, yeah, I think biomedical science is the best fit for you.
Yes.
That's the one that you should do. So, okay, I'll do that then. First year was difficult, I'd say. It was challenging. But I think that kind of propelled me through my degree because whereas first year, I think it can be quite similar to A-level, it's kind of going back over and reiterating A-level and then building on that knowledge. It was really quite new to me. Mm-hmm. And I do recall there was a time that I was in the library with this said friend who did the Access course and was working on an assignment. And I picked up a book off the shelf. I think it was Leninger's Book of Biochemistry. And I remember opening this book and we both looked at it and looked at each other and were like, what are we doing? What are we doing here? Quickly shut it, put it back. Oh, my goodness. I think we're in the wrong place. Because I was coming out of lectures and I'm thinking, I have no idea what he's talking about. It was
a real challenge.
It was a real challenge. But because of that, I had to really work hard to try and understand. You know, I had to go home and read these textbooks and then,
you say that's the way you love to learn.
Yeah,
so it almost drove that, didn't it?
It did. I mean, I love lectures. I mean, being back at university now, I absolutely love lectures. And some people think I'm strange when I say that. I really enjoy that. Mm-hmm. But I often find I need time to digest information. So sometimes they're too quick. But I think, obviously, people have different learning styles. And I do find I can get, as much as I'm enjoying the lecture, I can get easily distracted by it. I tend to find myself focusing on people, how they're presenting or their excitement about it. And what did they just say? But then it's gone, that slide's gone. And now I'm on to the next one. And now I'm like, I'm lost. I'm confused. Where were they at? So I did really enjoy lectures, but I found the eureka moments were when I got home and started reading it, or actually some really good resources online where you can watch videos and have someone explain it to you sort of in really simple terms, and you can pause and rewind.
Different ways. Until it clicks.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think because I'd had to work so much harder to try and get to the level of the A-level students who had literally just finished, you know, they've done the GCSEs and they're A-level.
Straight into A-levels, very traditional route.
Yeah, it was all fresh in their minds. And I had to work super hard to try and achieve that level. But that propelled me through second and third year because I then became so engrossed in it. I was like, this is amazing. Like, this is, oh my open God, this the is world. So exciting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I probably a bit too much. I have always struggled with work-life balance. Mm. I would tend to be constantly with my head in a book or doing an assignment or something. I'm a bit of a perfectionist, so I would spend far too long on mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. But I did also find that the information I was being given in the lectures, I wanted to know more. Mm-hmm. Oh, why does that happen? And I'm not one of those children. It's like, why? Why? Yeah. So everything I was being told, why does that happen? And then I'd find something else. Like, well, why does that happen? And then why does that happen? So it would open up this massive can of worms. I'm like, oh, yeah. where am I even going with this? And so I'd get very engrossed in mm-hmm. science. And I thought, oh, yeah, I love this. But then at the end of, I think it was at the end of second year, we had immunology lectures mm-hmm. and I was really fascinated by the immune system. Mm-hmm. So I approached the lecturer and said, would I be able to get, because I thought it would be important to get some lab experience. Mm-hmm. People have talked about research projects and design experiments. Thought, how does that even happen? I can't even imagine. We did obviously do practical sessions during our degree, but it was very, you'd get a protocol and it was mm-hmm. very scripted. And I didn't particularly find that I enjoyed those mm-hmm. too much. They were good for learning basic skills, mm-hmm. but I couldn't imagine how you could translate that into actually doing your own experiments. Mm-hmm. It just seemed like such a massive leap. So I spoke to the lecturer and said, is there any chance of getting sort of lab experience? She said, yeah, you can apply for a sort of summer studentship. I said, I'm really interested in immunology. Would I be able to sort of get a studentship in that sort? She said, well, we don't really have any research in immunology at the uni, but there is a lecturer who does research into influenza virus. So you could apply for studentship doing that. So I did, and I got accepted, thankfully. And I spent, I think it was probably like 6 to 8 weeks doing research in his lab on influenza virus. And again, it was largely the fact that his PhD student, who was supervising myself and one other person who was doing studentship, was so excited about science and was mm-hmm. so passionate about what he was doing mm-hmm. that made me enjoy it so much. Mm-hmm. I had so much fun doing this studentship, doing actual real experiments.
Yeah.
Things could potentially be, you know, impacting patient care in the future, or sort of health and disease in the future. I was like, wow, this is amazing. I really love research. So, and I actually asked if I could carry on even when I'd finished the studentship, if I could, in my third year, could I keep coming back in the lab and, you know, just help out where I can? And yeah, of course you can. I think it was about that point I kind of thought, you know, maybe research is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. It had been the biomedical science route, I thought with research, you know, you've got the autonomy of sort of planning experiments, and I did fall in love with research at that mm-hmm. point. Mm-hmm. So after my degree, rather than going down the biomedical science route, because it was an accredited biomedical science mm-hmm. degree, but then to become a biomedical scientist, you then have to get a job in the hospital and sort of do a portfolio mm-hmm. and everything mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. register. So I thought, maybe I'll stay on at uni and do research instead for a while. I was really interested in immunology. Mm-hmm. Biology, you know, had some interest for me, but it was the cancer biology lectures that I was most interested mm-hmm. in. So I wanted to do research, but I knew it wasn't going to be, wasn't really that keen on virology per se. I wanted to do cancer biology research, which there were a couple of labs at mm-hmm. Our uni doing cancer research. And I managed to get a master's research project in a lab. Actually, it was a genetics lab.
Okay.
But it wasn't cancer genetics. Mm-hmm. It was actually genetic studies on all weird and wonderful things. So they were looking at sort of evolution of mm-hmm. dinosaurs to birds and things like that. Mm. And so this was going on around me in the lab, but I was the only person actually in the lab doing the cancer biology. This was kind of like a side project for him. So I did that for a year, which was great. And then a PhD position was advertised at the uni, which seemed to combine all three of the things I liked because it was looking at a protein that's involved in the immune system, mm-hmm. that responds to viruses.
Yeah.
And as an off-target effect, cause cancer. So it was kind of like all three rolled into one.
Yeah.
It was kind of a bit of immunology, a bit of virology and cancer biology.
Sounds ideal.
Yeah, it was. It was ideal. So I applied for that and got the position.
Wow. Fantastic.
Thank you.
Fantastic. In all of that then, can you pinpoint when you heard about the term genetics?
I had heard about the STP during my degree, but at that point they weren't, the cancer genomics wasn't one of the specialisms.
Mm-hmm.
The project that I was working on, so this protein that I mentioned, that its mechanism was that it responds to viral infections, mm-hmm. and in doing so it causes mutations in the genome of the virus, mm-hmm. to try and limit its replication. Mm-hmm. But as I was saying, the off-target effect was that it can cause mutations in the host genome, mm-hmm. and lead to cancers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the degree didn't actually have genetics or genomics element to
really?
It, the biomedical science degree. So I didn't actually have any modules in genetics or genomics. But what I was working on was kind of to do with the genome and to do with cancer and how mutations that are caused by these enzymes can can lead to cancer. So I think it was probably loosely in those terms, although it wasn't strictly genetics or genomics, it was in a roundabout way because it was causing these very specific signature mutations that are found in the host genome as a result of the innate immune response to viruses.
Mm-hmm. So from your PhD, at which point did you come across the STP training program?
The PhD project ended up being 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew towards the end of my PhD, I had considered my options, and I knew at that point that I didn't want to be an academic.
Mm-hmm.
I was enjoying the research very much, but I also was conscious of the fact that I felt that it was kind of moving away from my goal of sort of healthcare. It felt sometimes quite removed.
Mm-hmm.
It was two elements, really. One is I felt that my knowledge was getting narrower and narrower again. Because so when you come out of your degree, you feel like you know a little bit about lots of things. And then when you're doing a PhD, you know hopefully a lot more about
one tiny
one
element.
Thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I felt that my knowledge was getting a lot narrower. But I also felt like I was moving away from that element of sort of where is this going to lead? It was it just seemed so far removed from actually how is this going to benefit people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that it can in the future. Obviously, with all research, it's all important. But when I would hear about other people's projects, so other labs within uni would have sort of collaboration with local hospitals and they would be working on something that would be, and I did feel again this little pang of envy. Like, oh, that sounds really interesting. Your project is so much closer to actually seeing the results and how that can help people.
Mm-hmm.
So I did feel, on one hand, I knew that I didn't want to be an academic.
Mm-hmm.
Did enjoy research. If it was going to be research still, it needed to be something with more of a clinical element to it, and possibly in industry.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not quite sure how I came across the STP, because, as I said, I wasn't aware that they had a cancer genomics arm to it. I think it was possibly sort of looking at how what other jobs in healthcare to do with cancer, and there's not many research roles within the NHS, but I think it was at that point I came across the STP. I was like, wow, I've got a cancer genomics element now. I'm sure that it didn't have that before, and I think I just started sort of 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that would be absolutely perfect. So I watched a couple of their webinars. I'm like, yes, that is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
My project had that there was funding to then went on to sort of a postdoc position and research fellowship position. So I accepted that, but my boss knew that it was on the condition this is what I want to do. I don't want to be an academic.
Yeah,
I need to see where I'm going to go from here, and this is what I want to do. So I will do the project, but I am, just so you know, I'm applying for the STP. So I was like, yes, but I was also aware that it's very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any healthcare experience, which is obviously favourable. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had, good knowledge of lab work, that mm-hmm. sort of experience. But as I've learned, that's quite different. Mm-hmm. It's what you're doing in research is all very manual, mm-hmm. Whereas this is obviously automated and a lot of quality control checks. Mm-hmm. It's just almost not entirely different. But when it's talking about DNA and RNA extraction, it's not the DNA and RNA extraction I'm used to. It's a completely same end result, different process. So mm-hmm. I would naively thought that I've got all this lab experience. Surely it would be. I can't understand why you would need so much healthcare experience as well, but I can now see why it's really beneficial to have had that lab experience within a hospital environment or other environments and to learn those processes, which can be quite different.
Yeah. You mentioned that it can be quite difficult to get on the STP. What was your experience?
Yes, in the first year I applied, I wasn't even shortlisted. It's quite a long process and it can be quite, you have to bear with it, I would mm-hmm. say, it can, because it's about a sort of 6 month process. And mm-hmm. I wasn't shortlisted the first time. And I thought, oh no, I knew I really wanted to do this. I was quite gutted, to be honest. But I knew that apply again next year. And it is competitive and certain specialisms are more competitive than others. But I knew that the downside of the cancer genomics was that the closest location for me would be London. Mm-hmm. So I would have a long commute or have to move. But I thought, no, cancer genomics, it's going to have to be, it's what I want to do. Mm. There was an immunology side, but it would have been the cancer immunology that I was interested in.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to have to either move or commute because it has to be cancer genomics. It's the only one I really want. So the following year, applied again. I thought, if I didn't get in last year, haven't changed anything. Yeah. And what I would suggest to to other people is to get additional skills and experience during that time. But I was working really long hours on my project and I was thinking, I don't know what else I can do that, this is what my skills and experience. Yeah. I would say that not everybody's on the program has had healthcare experience. There's been lots of different routes in. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get it. As I said, I didn't get in last year. I applied again and thankfully I was successful. But there's a whole range of experience. I mean, even on our intake. So I've gone through the PhD route and one of the other ladies has gone through a PhD mm-hmm. route. One of the ladies has, she's come straight from a master's mm-hmm. Without any lab. Well, she's had lab experience, but not within the NHS mm-hmm. or in industry. It really is a whole range of skills and experience. So I would definitely say to anybody who wanted to apply and wasn't successful, if that's what you really want to do, then to persist and try and sort of, if there's a way of building up on your skills and experience and getting... some experience within the healthcare, it really helps with the application, I think, and also getting an understanding with it. Make sure, one thing I will say from my journey is make sure you know what you want to do. It's not always easy to know what you want to do when you're young. It's a big ask of any 18 or 19 or 16 year old to say, what are you going to do for the rest of your life? So I think it'd be really nice if people at that age could have more experience in the job that, I want to do this. Okay, we'll go and spend 2 weeks in that job. Are you sure you really want to do that sort of thing? So,
from the STP role, what are your kind of biggest challenges that you have in the role?
I'd say possibly the biggest challenges, I wouldn't see them as challenges as such, but you have a lot of competencies to write. Had found that I preferred the service work to mm-hmm. writing the competencies. I feel like I'm actually contributing to something.
Mm-hmm. That kind of, not even necessarily academic, but kind of like school learning, meeting competencies, ticking boxes, as opposed to, just delivering, like you say, a clinical service. It's, it's the theory and the you know, meeting the stand, you know, demonstrating you're meeting the standards when actually you're getting so much from the clinical work that you know that's where you're getting to and where you want to get to. But as you say, it's kind of, it's a necessarily evil, isn't it, really, to demonstrate, you know, that you're getting there.
You don't realise what you're learning at the time and how important it is. But I felt that we were shadowing people, and people giving so much time to us to explain things so fully. And I did feel like, I found that slightly challenging. I want to do something. I can do this. Let me help. But until you are competent, obviously you can't help for obvious reasons. But I did find that I'm here. What can I do? But so that was slightly challenging at the beginning.
Can I ask, what do your son and your daughter then think about the fact that you're now training to be a clinical scientist? They gone into science as well, or?
Absolutely not.
They're rebelling like you were.
Absolutely not. One thing I have learned from the way I am with my poor mum, I love my mum to bits. I'm sorry, I'm so terrible, terrible daughter. One thing I have learned is I try not to tell them what they should do, because I know they'll probably do the opposite.
Mm.
With my daughter, I think she probably did a similar sort of thing to me. She had decided, she did her A-levels, but then where she'd applied to uni, she suddenly changed her mind. And, oh, I don't want to do uni. So she left, but then ended up doing an open university degree.
Mm-hmm.
She decided it was what she wanted to do, and she'd become a teaching assistant and hoping to become a teacher.
Fantastic.
In the future. Yeah. Whereas my son, again, I would say similar to me in that when he finished his A-levels a year ago, he didn't know what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so took a year out. He said he's been working and he had decided he wasn't going to uni. I'm like, absolutely fine. If you don't want to go to uni, if you don't know what you want to do, there's no point doing something until you know what it is you want to do. So he's taken a year out, and then all of a sudden out of the blue said, I'm going to uni. Okay. What are you going to do? Business. Okay. So we're probably quite spontaneous people. As for the question about my daughter, she's probably I'm not so sure she's excited about me doing science, but I think she'd probably prefer me doing a job where I might be available for babysitting a bit more often.
Rather than studying and work.
Yeah.
So it's utterly incredible, Nikki, like your enthusiasm from, you know, kind of, like you say, your spontaneity in buying horses to doing the police to, and all those like wonderful life skills that you're now bringing to that role as a clinical scientist. I'm sure you'll make a brilliant one. Where do you think your ambition will take you from here?
At the moment, my ambition is to finish all my competencies, to finish my portfolio, to become a registered clinical scientist. I want to enjoy the journey, though. I've got 2 years left, and I think the unique thing about the STP is you get these opportunities to see these different departments that I'm not saying that you don't as a clinical scientist, because I don't know this to be true or not true, but the STP offers a really good opportunity to be spending the next 10 to 12 weeks at haematology at King's, and that's going to be so insightful.
It sounds like an incredible combination of the theory, observing the clinical, and you know, embedding the practice. It sounds like a real trio of those three things.
Really is. So I do feel incredibly lucky to be on the program, because it's I want to make the most of it. I'm really looking forward to the haematology rotation, and then after that in the new year we've got a solid cancers rotation, so again another 10 to 12 weeks, I think it is. I'm not entirely sure. So I always feel like I've got so much more to learn. I really have at this point. I'm only sort of tip of the iceberg. So
I think it's absolutely amazing that you're using your kind of drive to want to know more and your enthusiasm to put that into what will be ultimately patient care in, you know, kind of through the clinical scientist role.
But
been absolutely amazing talking to you. And I, you know, kind of, I started by talking about the twists and turns of your career, but I think I was thinking, I think it's more of a Big Dipper ride really with the discussion, but it's just been fascinating to hear. It really is. So thank you so much for coming and joining us.
Thank you.
If you would like more information about the topics that we have discussed today, then you can find these on both websites.
ny-genomics.org.uk/podcast and southeastgenomics.nhs.uk/GMSA. You'll also find here all the episodes in our podcast series. All episodes can also be accessed via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all other major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.